is no longer able to bring in essential needs such as flour and rice, etc.
Israel says the closure of Gaza's crossings will remain in place until Hamas's rocket fire from Gaza into Israel stops. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in southern Gaza.
And that will do it for today's newscast. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
And you're listening to 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York. The time is 7 p.m., time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. For Billy Bones was the best.
Good evening, everyone. The program is Off the Hook. This is Red Hacked here in the studio. I'm joined by Mike.
Hi there.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Not Kevin.
Hello.
Voltaire.
Salutations.
And I believe we have Emmanuel on the line. Hello?
Yes. Actually, I didn't think of a clever word to say to indicate that I'm here. But I guess instead I'll just be clever by saying that I'm somewhere else. I'm not in this country anymore. I am down in South America, in Brazil. I believe I mentioned this last week, in São Paulo right now, having just attended the YSTS 2.0 conference.
I think we also have on the telephone Bernie S.
Greetings from Pennsylvania. I'm not in Philadelphia, but I'm still in Pennsylvania. So tell us about the conference, Emmanuel.
Well, actually, I'm going to do better than that. I'm going to hand you to one of the coordinators of the conference, and he'll be able to tell you all about that as well. But before I do that, I'd like to see if anybody's there. First of all, everybody get away from your computer and don't log on to anything like Google or Cha-Cha or Wikipedia, anything like that, okay? I want for people in the studio to guess what the time difference is between New York and São Paulo right now.
2 hours.
All right. That's
I'm guessing it's the same, or maybe 1 hour. 1 hour.
Okay. All right. About other people in the studio?
3 hours.
All right, keep going.
Because
5 hours.
Well, daylight saving, that's 2 or subtract 2, whichever.
We are on the same side of the Atlantic Ocean. You realize that?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with minus
all right, well,
1 hour.
I'll spill the beans. It is 3 hours. We are 3 hours. Wait a minute. 3 hours in which direction?
Are you ahead?
Yeah, you have to be ahead.
Yeah, we are ahead. It's kind of confusing because they're on daylight savings time now, and we're not on daylight savings time. And there's a period of time where they are on daylight they're not on daylight savings time, and we are still on daylight. There's a period of time where we're both on daylight savings time, is what I'm trying to say. And then there's a period of time when we're not and they are, et cetera. So the time difference changes, I think, 3 different times a year.
I've noticed a real shortage of daylight here in New York. Maybe it's a mistake we're making by not saving it.
I'm not sure how that works exactly, but it is almost summer down here. It's actually late spring. Although you wouldn't really guess it by walking around. It's been raining just about every day, and it hasn't been that hot, so I'm actually pretty happy with that. But here's something interesting. When I first got here, I brought 2 phones with me, as I usually do. I had my CDMA phone, which I subscribed to Verizon, and I have my GSM phone, which is subscribed to T-Mobile. Now, the CDMA phone is using a different company down here. I haven't dared to use it because I'm afraid of what it might cost. But the CDMA phone, as just about all of them do, displays the time as it gets it from the tower, and the time was right. The time was, in fact, 3 hours ahead of New York time. However, the GSM phone was 2 hours ahead of New York time, and I couldn't figure out where my phone thought it was, because I don't know of any place nearby that's 2 hours. And even if you take into account the changing of the clock, I don't think that would have made any sense either. And then a few hours after I arrived, it just reverted to the proper time. So if anybody has any theories as to what exactly was going on with my GSM phone, I'd sure like to hear about them.
I think it was frightened.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Okay, what I'd like to do now is hand the phone over to Luis Eduardo, who is the coordinator of the YSTS 2.0 conference. YSTS stands for You Shot the Sheriff, and I guess maybe the first question I'm going to ask Luis to answer is why that name, and you guys feel free to jump in with any questions of your own. Here's Luis.
How's it going, guys?
Hi, Luis.
Hey.
How are you?
Greetings.
Good. How are you? So, Good. Yeah, You Shot the Sheriff. Why You Shot the Sheriff? Me and two other guys, William and Nelson, down here in Brazil, we do actually a security podcast called I Shot the Sheriff, because of the song. So last year we came up with the idea of doing a conference and bringing people together to pretty much have a different type of conference, security conference, that has all different types of talks, possible talks, politics and the hacker community and technical stuff, and get in a more interactive way. So instead of I Shot the Sheriff, we turned that into, for the conference, You Shot the Sheriff. So the attendees would have a better participation on the conference. That's why.
So what are some of the things you have at this conference?
So it's a one-day conference. The way that we do it was on a different venue from last year. The venue is always a bar or a club or something like that. It's an open bar type of conference from 1 o'clock on. So to get people more relaxed and being free to ask questions and be a little bit more relaxed. And the types of talks that we had, some guy talked about the different uses or misuses of the term hacker, for example. So it was more like a political, like on the political side. We had Hikari, who runs Torcon, talking about FPGAs and rainbow tables. We got Emmanuel talking about the three decades of hacking, like pretty much covering the book, and another guy talking code boot attacks. So it's a pretty good mix of everything. So we try to bring everybody together to talk about everything about security and try to merge everything or bring everybody under the same roof at least once a year.
About how many people are at this conference, and are they all from Brazil? Obviously, Emmanuel's not from Brazil, but what other countries are represented, and how many people are there?
We had about the same number of people that we got last year, that were about 80 people total. That's as much as the venues that we got could handle. And most of the people are from Brazil. I want to say everybody, but this year, just David, Hikari, and Emmanuel that flew down from the U.S.
Well, it sounds like a good time. You're going to do it again next year?
It was fun. You guys can ask Emmanuel later, but, yeah, it was fun. And he was here last year, too, so he may be able to give a better view, like an outside view of how it was compared to last year.
You're going to do it again next year?
Hopefully, yes. The plan is to do the third edition next year, yes.
Well, anything else our listeners should know about this conference or might want to know, even if they shouldn't?
Keep an eye out. We're going to do a little bit of advertisement for next year. It's not going to be like a two-day lead time or a two-month lead time, but we're going to give a better heads-up for people to want to come down. And last year we had more people from abroad. Felix from Germany was here. Nick Farr, that a lot of people know, was here. And so hopefully next year we're going to get more people to come down to Brazil and have more fun and hopefully do a two-day conference instead of a one-day gig.
Do you have a website we could check out?
Yeah, the website is
YSTS.org.
As in you shot the sheriff.org.
Yes, exactly.
And will the audio or video, or audio and video
be available? We have the videos. Yeah, we have on the archives. So you have, like, if you go to the website, you're going to see everything in Portuguese, but there's an English link there. If you click there and you go to archives, we got all the videos from last year on Google Video. And as soon as time permits, once we decompress from the whole craziness that is to run this, we're going to be posting the videos from this year's talks as well.
Great. Are just the audio files available for people that want to walk around and listen to them on their MP3 players?
No, but that's something that we could actually do. We could get audio files also. That's a really good idea. Thanks.
Great.
Okay, so again, for our listeners, if you're interested in looking at that, that's at ysts.org. Anyone else have any questions?
So what else is going on down there in Brazil?
At this point in time, what else is going on? Not much. Pretty much everybody seems to be ready for Christmas. So we have Christmas lights all over the place already and shopping malls, everybody going crazy with Christmas and Santa Claus and I don't know. We don't have Thanksgiving here, so I guess we want to be the U.S. on that and start selling stuff. I guess that's the idea.
Sounds very cool. I know it's probably a bit soon to be asking, but any ideas for floating around for next year?
For what? I'm sorry?
For next year's con?
You mean like a time frame or when we're going to be doing it?
Possibly, or just any ideas you have in mind for things to maybe for different things to do or some other things?
Well, yeah, as I said, we're going to try to do a two-day thing instead of a one-day thing, but like the topics or whomever we're going to do again, this was the first year we actually had a call for papers. And again, anything security goes. If you think it'd be like a smaller HOPE/CCC type of thing, different than other like conferences that are more focused on only just technical stuff.
And is this a mixed language conference, or is it all in Portuguese or all in English?
It is a mixed language conference. Most of the people here, actually, they understand English. Usually we speak slowly. But, yeah, we're going to try to get translation as well because this year and last year we didn't have. And some of the guys that came from abroad, they said, well, that was really cool, but I didn't understand anything that people said. Although some of the speakers, and we requested that, and some of them actually did it, they had slides in English. So that was pretty cool. Makes it easier to follow, although you're not understanding anything. But at least we got beer. Makes it a little bit better.
Would you say there's a strong hacker presence in Brazil or Latin America as a whole?
In Brazil, there's a lot of activity actually down here. It's quite interesting the way the security community is. It's not set up, but how it grew here. And it's in a maturing phase as far as I see. That's one of the reasons one of the motivations that I had last year to put this together is to try. Now, of course, we're always going to get the differences between all kinds of level of people, right? The management people and all the underground people, of course. It's pretty normal for them to kind of dislike each other, but at the same point, it's pretty, sometimes they fear whatever they don't know or they hate something they really don't understand. So that's, at least the idea is to make sure that they understand what's happening. But yeah, there's a strong presence, all over the board, across the board, I want to say, from the underground community all the way up to the management folks, CSOs, and that stuff. That actually some people that are actually up there understand what they're saying.
So what led to the beginning of this? I know you said you have a podcast. Did it all come from that, or?
Yeah, one day I was actually down here because actually I live in California, so I was down here with one of the other organizers, and we were doing the podcast for a few months already, I think about 8 months. Now in December, it's going to be 2 years that we've been doing that. And people really like whatever we do just because we don't have any strong opinions about anything because we really, no one can really understand, have
really fully understand everything that goes on. So we really make fun of each other and just try to make things easy and just open people's minds to see, okay, this might be cool or this might be totally bogus, or just talk about stuff that happened in the past week in the security community. And people kind of, like, everybody kind of liked what we did, so we said, why not keep do a conference, a smaller one, and keep the same format? And that seemed to have worked out. Because this year, people really liked what we did.
Sounds good. Where can we check out your podcast?
Podcast is, the website is, well, it's going to be in Portuguese, so if you want to practice your Portuguese, and it's going to be the website, and it's spelled N as in Navy, AOEOD.com.br.
Okay.
It's a joke with iPod. Instead of iPod, that means no pod in Portuguese.
So as somebody who's lived in both the United States and Brazil, would you say that, I'm sure you're aware that at least in the United States, there's a lot of, like, data breaches as in terms of personal data and social security numbers being leaked. Would you say that this is, like, better or worse in Brazil?
Which one of those?
Like theft of personal information and things like that, electronically.
Like, because of corporate negligence, I guess, mostly.
Keeping this type of data where? Sorry, I missed the whole thing.
Unlike when you hear about banks losing all their customers' information and all the...
Right.
And compromising up social security numbers and the like, and credit card numbers. Does this happen a lot in Brazil as well?
It does. Actually, it does, and it's not only... It's kind of an interesting question, because especially here in São Paulo, they have to try to avoid tax corruption, I want to say. They're requiring people to kind of force the vendor or whatever store, retail stores, to give out the invoice or something similar to that. And in order to do that, they ask you for your social security number, the Brazilian social security number. Once, so you show up, you pay, they're like, do you want that? And you say yes. So they're like, in front of everybody, what's your social security number? So it's kind of like lame. But they also print that out on checkbooks, so that there's no point.
Can that number be used in the same way that it is in the U.S.? Is it used to identify you to things like banks and credit cards?
Unfortunately, yes. Hmm. Yes, that can be used to identify yourself, yes, in the bad way as well.
All right.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, so it could be... So in our case in the U.S., you don't have that much information. Well, what you have is your address, but that can always change. But at least you might have your SSN on your checkbook. That's because if you lose it or something like that, that's bad.
Yeah.
But again, soliciting that in front of everybody in a retail store, that's not good either.
But is there a large-scale theft of things like that, or is it more small-scale, like if you were to lose, you know, one person loses something or says it out loud, or are there breaches, technical breaches? Also,
well, yeah. So this is the usability type of problem, but yeah, you have the other problems as well. Mm-hmm. Not only of people, like insider people working and getting this type of information from banks or from public places and putting out CDs and selling on the street for $10, or not $10, but this would be more than that. It would be like, I don't know how much that would be actually, but yeah, this is the kind of stuff that you can actually find and buy on the black market. And that's pretty bad. And, of course, people also hack into systems and can get that kind of information. Or sometimes what happened was on the news not too long ago. What they were selling was actually not personal data, but credentials to get into databases that you could get access to any personal data.
So you've been involved in the hacker communities in Brazil and in the United States. What would you say is the way that in the United States the hacker community has a certain image that people on the street would, you know, think about, whether it's demonized or whether it's over glamorized in Hollywood? Would you say that the hacker community in Brazil has a similar issue going on?
It from a
motivation standpoint, yes. I want to say that, yes, they might get motivated for the same reasons or just for the wrong reasons sometimes, just while they see movies and things like that. But on the other hand, what happens is information technology is just another tool to do bad things. So if you look back when people like were like a few years ago, when people they were after keyloggers and maybe, like talking about internet banking and things like that. Actually, as long as I remember, Brazil started with internet banking before the U.S. around like 1995, 96. I don't recall seeing anything in the U.S. like that, but I could be wrong. So when people were talking about keyloggers, some banks, they had a virtual keypad, and I think that Brazil was the first one to have that. So people actually, instead of doing keyloggers, they created the malware that would actually take the screenshots. So every time you click your mouse, it'd say, yeah, you click this and this and this, and if you to figure out the password. So they're always changing. It's that arm wrestling kind of thing, right? Technology and trying to find ways around it. But here, just because they're so, it's not there's so much money. It depends who pays for the thing. So in the U.S., people, the user, they might not be that worried about getting identity fraud or something like that because the bank pretty much is insured. In Brazil, it's the legality, it's kind of iffy because, let's say, if you go to an ATM, not talking about internet banking now, but real banking, if you go to an ATM machine and you get robbed inside the premises of an ATM machine, the bank is responsible for that. But if you get hijacked and they take you there and they make you take the money out, and once you leave, they take your money, then it's not the bank's fault anymore. So they try to translate that to internet banking. So they say, well, if it was something, if your Windows or whatever OS you're running, it's not patched, and you're infected by something that is going to cause fraud later, they try to say that was the user's fault. Like, they do as much as they can to say, yeah, it's the user's fault, it's not our fault, we're not going
to
pay.
So they don't have any motivation to go after the criminals at all? They just say it's your fault and too bad?
Yeah, because it's cheaper, right? It's the same thing. How much money are they going to invest to protect the user? They try, and actually they've been, for the past few years, they've been, like, increasing a lot. Like, some of the banks, they offer for free RSA tokens and things like that. Even for ATM machines, it's painful sometimes. Like, my mom, she has her ATM card, she knows her PIN number, and then she has a poor man's RSA card that has, like, 50 passwords on it. So when you go to the ATM machine, it says, what's your PIN number? After you put the PIN number, it says, type password number 42. And then you go on your card, and you see password 42 is blah, blah, blah. And then you type that on the machine. For us geeks, that would be okay, but for some people, that is not okay. And then coming back to the internet fraud, what happens is people send, of course, spams saying, hey, go to, this is your bank, go here, and by the way, type all 50 passwords. And talking to people here, actually, some people that don't understand, they were there typing all 50 passwords on this website just because they thought it was a bank. Like something, type all 50 passwords to verify or to activate your card. It's lame, but it works.
That's very interesting, so actually. I don't know if a system like that could take off in this country when people seem to have the same four-digit PIN on everything in their life, and they wouldn't be into looking up password number 42.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that.
The ability is what they say, well, this is a way for you to be safe.
Yeah.
Defined safe.
I've seen that in use in Europe for banking, but only internet banking, not for ATMs. So, you know, it makes sense because you could be accessing it from any machine as opposed to the machine they control. But I think it'd be maybe a little overkill for ATMs. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the other thing they do here as well is integration with cell phones as well. So when you go to an internet banking website, assuming you're in the right place, they ask you to register your cell phone. So for some transactions, actually, you have to, they send you an SMS, and you have to verify whatever they send you by SMS. But again, the same way that they have different ways to protect, you have other possible attack factors.
Right.
So it just keeps going.
All right. Well, thanks, Luis. Will we see you in Berlin this December?
Hopefully, yeah. Hopefully. Everybody's talking about going to CCC, so got my arm twist, I guess.
All right.
Have some club mate there.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, and sounds like it was a good conference.
Okay. Hope to see you guys here next year.
All right. Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Take bye. Care. All right, that's Luis Eduardo we're just talking to, coordinator of the Shot the Sheriff conference here in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Actually, I just wanted to ask Luis one or two other things concerning, well, I mean, it's just great to talk to people down here and see the interest level that people have towards the hacker history, the hacker world. And the one thing, though, that most of them have not done is travel to the United States to become part of something like HOPE. And Luis, by the way, is one of our coordinators at the HOPE conferences. I'd like to ask Luis, is there anything that he thinks that we can do to get people to come to the U.S. and take part in the hacker community there?
Well, number one is get a visa. Sometimes getting a visa is a problem. So, and it actually became a problem for people from the U.S. to come to Brazil as well because of this reciprocity. But I think what a real example is a few years ago, I tried to get my parents to go visit me where I live, and I was living there for a few years already, and they simply got turned down because the person who was processing their visas simply didn't understand that. That they are retired, they have no tax return forms, or actually the tax return because they're exempt of that, and that was seen as a bad thing. So if a person that has worked all their lives, or if people that who have worked all their lives and stuff like that cannot make to the U.S., imagine somebody that is starting as a security professional or a hacker or just wants to go there to join a conference or other conferences, and they're going to say, what are you going to be doing there? Like if you say, I want to go to Disney World, it was already really hard to say, yeah, I'm a hacker. I want to go to a hacker conference to network and meet cool people and learn cool stuff. That's going to be even harder. So I don't know. Maybe creating a special visa type would be a good idea, you know, LEAP one or something like that.
Okay, thanks, Luis. Actually, I also wanted to remind people, we have CCC coming up in Germany, in Berlin, in December of this year. Go to ccc.de for information on that hacker conference coming up. But we have something exciting to announce for next year. I believe the phrase this time is HAR.
Yeah, HAR. I heard something about that.
Hacking at random. What do you know? Do you have something with you? I have it here if you don't.
It's another conference in the Netherlands, I guess, hot on the tails of last year's CCC camp and 4 years ago's What the Hack. And it's HAR 2009, so... Looks interesting.
And HAR, of course, stands for Hacking at Random. Mm-hmm.
Of course.
And this is scheduled to take place August 13th through 16th of 2009. And it's taking place. Does anybody want to try to pronounce this town, or are you going to leave it to me?
I think it's your job.
Yeah, you can do it.
All right. Leerhouten. Hey, I think that came out all right.
I think people are...
Leerhouten, Netherlands, is where that's going to be taking place. For more information, go to... HAR, HAR2009.org, and you'll find out everything there is to know right now.
It's about an hour and a half from Amsterdam by train, because, of course, you can take a train to tiny little towns in Holland. It looks like they've got a program committee set up, and the planning is starting.
We even have more exciting news than that. Turns out there's going to be a hacker camp right there in the United States, where you guys are, next year as well. This will be taking place in Washington State, I believe, sometime during the month of May. It's going to be called Tour Camp, and it's organized by the same folks who bring you TourCon in Seattle and San Diego. And we'll have more information on that with specific dates and details and ways of getting involved as we get them. But that's exciting news to think that it's actually going to happen in the United States, a hacker camp. I never thought I'd be able to say that, but it's actually being organized, and it looks like it's going to be really cool. I talked to the coordinator of it while we were both down here in Sao Paulo, and the planning is really proceeding nicely, and this could be on par with the European hacker camps.
for anyone who's never been to one of these camps, I really highly recommend them. They're something unique for sure. It's really different when you kind of take it outside. I don't know how to describe it, but it's really nice. So if you can't make it to the Netherlands,
nice phrase there. Take it outside, but yeah, I guess that it does add something to the whole hacker world when you do that.
Yeah.
Okay, we have all kinds of other bits of information that have been sent to us by our listeners that we've uncovered ourselves. One thing I'd like to just mention this because we were talking about this last week, the .gov site, which is I guess some of the clearinghouse information on .gov sites. Our friend Risk Taker writes in to say the website at .gov, which, by the way, those of you who wanted to get there, you spell out the first .gov, .gov, and then it's actually a period, .gov. That's how you get there. That website mentioned by one of your callers is inaccessible from my German IP address. However, for my U.S. shell account, it works fine. So it would seem that not only do you have to be a government agency to obtain a .gov domain, but you also have to be using a U.S. IP. And I tried that from down here in Brazil, and it does not work from down here as well. So I guess you have to be in the United States or using a U.S. IP in order to reach that site. Have any of you guys visited the .gov site?
That's really boring. apparently it costs $150. In addition to being a government agency, you have to pay $150 to get one of these domains.
There were some...
Go ahead, Bernie.
I'm sorry. There was some controversy amongst us as to how certain .gov domain names can legally exist. For instance, last week I mentioned rnc.gov. It was mistaken. It's actually gop.gov, which is GOP is a common abbreviation for Grand Old Party, meaning the Republican Party. Gop.gov is a domain name with the. It's not a government agency yet. It's a has blatant political information on there about the Republican Party and sort of putting down other parties. And we're kind of puzzled as to how this domain name can legally exist.
Well, change.gov exists, and he's not president yet.
True, but if you look at the protocols for registering a .gov domain name, I can't find any way either of these organizations can qualify for one. But I guess it's who you know.
Yeah.
Change.gov, by the way, spammed me today. I had sent a week or two ago, they have a form where you can send your suggestions, your policy suggestions to the president-elect, so I did that, and I didn't get any substantive response to my email, somewhat unsurprisingly, but apparently now I'm on some mailing list where they tell me to go watch videos about things I don't care about. It's very strange.
I don't know. I think it's a difference between someone spamming you and you emailing them and then sending you something back that you don't want.
I did not opt in to any change.gov announcements mailing list, that's for sure.
Were you given an opportunity?
Oh, you might have. Just by sending the mail in the first place. I don't know.
If you
I haven't gotten an email from them, I'll tell you that.
If you want change, then you have to opt into our mailing list.
You might be happy to know that they actually took down that form, but most people that were talking about that were kind of upset because they were like, you don't care about my concerns. So maybe they're just protecting them from their spam. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I know they don't care about my concerns, but if they're going to pretend to, they could pretend more effectively.
Yeah, and on that .gov,
interesting surveillance stuff that's going on in the news lately. Did you guys hear about this story? This is actually on the front page of the Times. This guy that was accused of murder, in fact, was locked up for murder, has been released because of his MetroCard. That's right. His lawyer decided to take a look at his MetroCard and discovered that it backed up his alibi perfectly, saying that he had gotten on a train at one point, gotten on a bus at another point. If he had done all that, there's no way that he could have committed the murder. And the MetroCard is being hailed as a hero here. It saved the guy from going to prison. It's simply incredible, and it's obvious that what we need is more surveillance of this sort, more ways that our whereabouts can be tracked at every moment so that when we don't commit murders, we can prove it.
Now, was this a pay-per-ride thing, or was it a credit card? Did he buy it with a credit card? Because I'd be curious.
It was an unlimited ride. It wasn't when he bought it. It was when he used it, and it was an unlimited ride card.
Right.
And it backed up. In fact, they have a PDF on the New York Times website. You can look at his the printout. This is something you can't do for your own card. Mm-hmm. You can see his card and see everywhere he went, when it was used, and all the internal codes that the transit authority uses to track these things.
Because, I mean, I know that they track it to some degree in the fact that they can, if you, if your card is stolen or if somebody buys unlimited ride cards and you, with a credit card, they can shut it off. But I didn't know that they kept such extensive records.
Well, apparently this card was linked to him with the very simple means of getting his wallet that the police took when they arrested him, taking the Metro card out and noting the serial number.
Right.
It didn't require anything too sophisticated on that end.
Right, but for those unfamiliar with the Metro card, it's a completely generic card of which several billion exist, and I'm not sure exactly how they could tie it to him in the sense that it was him that used it to take the rides that that are on it.
One thing in the article, they talked, the headline and most of the paragraphs in the article were about the MetroCard, but sort of buried in this article, they did mention that one of the things he did that evening was go to a check cashing place where they took his photograph when they cashed the check. So there seems to be a lot of evidence that he was doing what he said he was doing and not what the police said he was doing.
And it should also be pointed out that he tried to tell the police to look at his MetroCard when he was arrested, and they did. They took it out of the wallet and they looked at it, and then they put it back. I think what he meant was that look at what was on the MetroCard, and they might actually find that it backed up his story. The first thing I suspected when I read the story was, yeah, he could just plan all that in advance, hand it to somebody, and have them go and do all this, and then give him back the wallet before he gets questioned. So a lot of planning to do. But the thing, I think the icing on the cake is the fact that he went to that check cashing place and his photo was right there. It's hard. Trust me, when you're committing a crime and you want something to work just exactly right, it's hard to get everything to line up perfectly like that. Almost never works.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. Now, as far as tracking and surveillance and things like that, there's a piece on MSNBC earlier this week that basically talked about how paranoia in, of all places, England, is on the rise. Irrational fears may be a lot more common than thought, according to surveys. Paranoia, once assumed to afflict only schizophrenics, is apparently a lot more common than previously thought. According to British psychologist Daniel Freeman, nearly one in four Londoners regularly has paranoid thoughts.
Emmanuel,
yes.
the three in four who don't always have, who don't constantly have paranoid thoughts, are none of them in the government there? Because
I don't think they went that far. I'm not sure if they gave that specific information. But what they found out was more than 8,500 adults, they found that 21% of the people thought there had been times when others were acting against them. Now, first of all, I don't think that's paranoid at all, because I think people are acting against us all the time. But then that probably just lumps me into that 21%. Now, another survey of about 1,000 adults in New York found that nearly 11% thought other people were following or spying on them. Now, the thing is, you know, you pick a city like London where you have cameras every few feet and all sorts of surveillance going on constantly. How can people not be paranoid about being watched and followed all the time?
This is what I don't understand. If only one-fifth of the people in the United Kingdom or in London think that there's this constant threat to their well-being, how do you explain the surveillance society? If 80% of the people feel safe, what are all these cameras for?
Well, that's another way of looking at it, I suppose, but I think
maybe the cameras make them feel safe.
The situation that they have over there when they're constantly being spied upon and constantly being told that there's danger. So, of course, people are going to feel vulnerable. Of course, they're going to be upset and paranoid. That's just what they're being taught.
Is this conspiracy theory paranoia, or is this just paranoia, mild paranoia?
I think it's just paranoia. I don't think it's that, to be honest. But I guess what they're trying to make it sound like is crazy, wacky, conspiracy theory-type people. But in actuality, it's a normal response to very stressful situations created by the authorities.
I'd like to add something to this. One of my favorite quotes is from the character Dr. Johnny Fever, who said, "When everyone's out to get you, paranoia is just good thinking."
Oh, Dr. Johnny Fever said that, eh?
Yes.
He's a true hero of mine.
All right.
Well then, any other news in the news?
Oh, there's plenty. There's plenty. Here's something that came out of Canada. This is kind of an interesting story that was forwarded to us. Canadian pilots are not happy these days about the increasing number of laser beams being pointed at their cockpits. That's right. Transport Canada statistics regarding the number of reported incidents of laser beams being pointed into the cockpits of airplanes have some pilots concerned the dangerous activity is becoming a growing trend. We don't want this to become a bigger hobby, a bigger stupid hobby, said Serge Beaulieu, spokesman for the Air Canada Pilots Association. Transport Canada's latest civil aviation daily occurrence reporting system reports, what a sentence that is. Transport Canada's latest civil aviation daily occurrence reporting system reports show that 62 incidents of the bright lights being pointed into cockpits have been reported so far in 2008. Six of those incidents occurred at Montreal Trudeau International Airport in just the last week. Other incidents have been reported in Winnipeg, Calgary, and Toronto. According to the reporting system, a total of 101 laser beam incidents have been reported since 1997. Basically, they're saying, or Bill Ure is saying, we want to put people on notice that this is dangerous, not funny, and you're potentially playing with the safety of people. Shining bright lights into the eyes of pilots can potentially be blinding, he says, and it's especially of concern since many of the reported incidents have taken place during landings. When we're doing takeoff or landing in an airplane, it's quite a busy time, and we want to be full up dealing with the task at hand. It's no time to get some yahoo flashing laser lights in the flight deck. It seems like common sense. They say, though, that this is probably the result of the powerful green light beams that are used by astronomers. They can travel several kilometers. They use to point to stars. It's according to the president of the Montreal branch of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada, Andrew Fezekis, it's they can cut through thick cardboards. You can light a match across the room just pointing this type of laser. Now, I'm not sure what he meant by that. You can't light things with these lasers. Does anybody know what that means?
Yes, you can. There are some, believe it or not, they're not legal for purchase in the United States, but there's some Chinese manufacturers who are making very high-power laser pointers that you can order from the United States. You can just you can search online and find these pretty easily. And some of them are several hundred milliwatts, like 500 milliwatts, 600 milliwatts, which is enough to cut through. For instance, a friend of mine came to Philadelphia and visited me with one of these, and we were able to pop a balloon with one of these laser pointers and cut a plastic bag with it. You can also ignite the head of a match. So these things, if something like that were to hit your retina, you would be very seriously permanently impaired from a visual standpoint, or basically blinded. Now, I don't think the pilots are in danger of being permanently blinded by this, because the time the laser beam reaches the plane, the power has dissipated a lot. But it's still dangerous from a standpoint of it's like a flash, a camera flash effect. You know, you're sort of dazed and blinded for a few seconds, and when someone's flying an airplane with a bunch of people on it, that's not a good thing.
Especially when they're landing.
It's I mean, basically, even if it doesn't cause permanent damage to the pilot's eye, it's the equivalent of that guy who likes to sit in a lawn chair and have a bunch of balloons, bring them up into the sky. If he does that right in front of a 747 that's trying to land, it's not going to hurt someone's eyes, but it's certainly going to distract the pilot and cause a potential disastrous effect. So if you have a laser beam out there, be careful where you use it. Don't point it up at the sky unless you know that there's nobody else up there.
All right.
We got some mail from last week's show concerning we were talking about virtual worlds and some of the insanity that's going on in virtual worlds. I think I had a little tirade about that myself. This writer writes in to say, I've noticed a few comments that have emerged on the show that indicates somewhat of a misunderstanding as to modern cyber culture in various areas. For a group of people who basically literally helped create that culture, I find it quite interesting that you are now throwing your hands in the air in bemusement at these crazy kids. The first comments I noticed were about the internet movement Anonymous and their protests against the Church of Scientology. There's a lot of disinformation and misunderstanding going on about this quote-unquote group. I would hope that you look into it further, as it is quite an interesting phenomenon that could not have occurred as readily without modern technology and the Internet. And I'm not, Kevin. I believe we have looked into this quite thoroughly, have we not?
Very thoroughly. We actually had them at our conference.
Yeah, they were at our conference. I think maybe this writer did not listen to the earlier show, so we talked about this. We know they're not a group. We know what these individual people stand for, and about the fight against Scientology, and the fact that it is significant. Would you say it's significant, then?
I would say it's quite significant, as they've shut down many of the churches throughout the world, so they're obviously doing something.
Yeah. Now, secondly, though, there is this issue about virtual property and how ludicrous some of you think it to be, particularly Emmanuel. Again, I just find it interesting that these ideas are so readily dismissed when the concept of virtual environments are so central to the hacker mindset. Although at first paying for clothing in Second Life or something like it may seem ridiculous, the psychological impact that it has on the individual is no different to buying clothes in real life. It is about the creation of identity and place within a community slash society. It is very clear that those who spend a lot of time within virtual environments feel this need to create identity just as strongly as anybody in the real world. Therefore, their transactions are incredibly similar in nature. Sure, there is an issue of tangibility of the items being bought, but remember that for the most part, these are microtransactions. You aren't spending $100 on a shirt, but rather 10 cents or something like that. Customizability is important to people. Identity is important to people to the extent that they will spend $10 to $20 or more to get it. Now, regarding the gifts in Facebook, paid gifts are pretty much dead in the water now since there are literally dozens of free applications that do the same thing. But the concept of it is indeed an interesting one. Why would you pay for something like an icon? And by pay, we're talking about only a dollar or so. Because you want to show the person that you mean it. It isn't just a flippant online interaction. You put your money where your mouth is, so to speak. Also, take note that many of these are done for charity, so there's a secondary reason there, too. I realize this email is way too long to be used for the program. You're mistaken there, too. But thank you for taking the time to read through it regardless, and I hope that some of the issues can be raised at some point in the future. Are you losing touch with the future? For so long you were at the forefront of technology, I'd hate to see it turn into a back-in-my-day situation. Signed, Dear Lucis from London. Now, I know, Rob, you had some very interesting comments on this whole tangibility issue and how much things cost in the virtual world. Anything you'd like to reflect upon here?
I did. You guys know I can get rather long-winded about this subject, but condensing it for the time we have left. Using Second Life as the example, as it is, the quote-unquote economy that's going on in there for things like virtual items, virtual clothing, and also virtual land, I have a big problem with the way that, it's been implemented. Basically, it's DRM-based, it's not user-friendly, and it's not quite honest with what it's doing technically, since anything you can buy is basically an image file and some 3D mapping data that is downloaded to your computer every time you use it. But basically, what I think we're seeing with companies like Linden Lab, who runs Second Life, and Blizzard, who runs World of Warcraft and other things, reminds me a lot of companies like America Online and CompuServe back in, say, the early 90s, where you had these closed systems popping up all over the place, which each on their own could be interesting, but it's just very contained and it's very controlled by those that are operating them. And my attention has been diverted from things like Second Life to there's one project called Open Simulator, which is an open source implementation of Second Life that anybody can run, and anybody can start up a server and connect it to others. And the ultimate goal is to create sort of an open protocol with which you can freely create what you want, you can express what you want, you can have all the individuality you like without paying one company for the privilege. And I think that's where the future of such things lie. I don't think we're losing touch with the future. I think we're just taking the first baby steps into such a future.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that what this writer says is that, yeah, there's no harm here because either microtransactions, 10 cents each, a few pennies, but that's not where it stops. There are so many more examples that go well into the realm of absurdity. I'm not in this world myself, and I do think it is a bit crazy. But aren't there people paying huge amounts of money for virtual property in places like Second Life?
There are. There are people who now make livings with stuff like that. There's one very prominent person in China who has basically become the Second Life equivalent of a land baron, just buying up and renting out, because people will actually rent this land to each other, buying and renting out land that all exist in this one company's servers. And basically, if things were opened up enough to where anybody could freely create, then there would be no market. Right now, what's called a market is just something completely artificially maintained and influenced by the company that's running it.
You know, and on top of that, the fact that they control the whole thing means that it doesn't develop very quickly. I'm sure I haven't seen much change in the software in ages.
Yeah.
I don't use it regularly, but it's not very good software to begin with.
Yeah, and I mean, I've dabbled in the whole land owning thing and content creation. I'm actually kind of active in some of the free content groups that exist within Second Life, which are neat ideas and everything. But at the end of the day, it is all contained in this one computer somewhere out in, I think, California. And
well, I have a question about this.
Yes.
If I was to go to this land baron's space in cyberspace in the virtual world, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and I was to destroy his entire property, raise it to the ground, burn it, whatever it takes in the virtual world, and it wasn't able to come back, and it was completely, I just somehow broke in and was able to do this. Would I be prosecuted in the virtual world or the real world?
The funny thing about that issue is that when you own quote unquote property in Second Life, you control what can happen on it. You control if other people can bring items onto it, if other people can execute code in their scripting language that they have for the behavior of these virtual items. So nothing can happen on your land that you don't want to. You can't go onto somebody's land and destroy it. They can just, limit what you're able to do and kick you off, basically.
How about if I hack into the machine that it's all hosted onto and erase everything? What happens then?
That would be interesting.
You do realize that people spend their money on all kinds of silly things that aren't virtual. I mean, I'm not exactly convinced that buying a Pixel T-shirt is any worse than buying some useless tchotchke that physically exists but serves no purpose. Like, I'm not really harmed by this virtual economy.
Well, you're not harmed, but people that are throwing money away literally because they're completely obsessed with this. It's the equivalent of throwing away money on lottery tickets. It's just, except you don't even get the ticket here. You're spending money literally on nothing.
Oh, really?
Just, in this day and age where the economy is really going down the crapper, I think we need to inject some common sense into the equation and realize that, it's fun to play games and things like that, but let's not inject real life into this any more than it has to be. I mean, there was a case just this last week where these people are getting divorced now because somebody was caught cheating in the virtual world with somebody, another avatar.
No,
I
thought there was
a
murder.
How crazy is it going to get? There's going to be murders going on in the virtual world, and people are going to go to real prisons.
Well, there was a virtual murder involved, I thought. Didn't she?
That was another case.
Oh, that's a different case.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah, somebody signed
unlimited
in.
Amount of cases here.
Yeah, somebody signed in as somebody else and, quote-unquote, killed their avatar in, I think it was a Japanese game. I'm not sure.
They didn't get charged for murder. They got charged for hacking the or unauthorized.
Right. That's good.
Wasn't the case we were talking about last week about a woman who was divorcing her real life husband because she caught him or she caught his avatar in a virtual world having sex with another avatar of apparently a woman, but nobody knows for sure. And
go ahead, Bernie. Well, Luis has a local perspective on this. I'd just like to make sure he gets this in quickly before we go off tonight. Hang on, Luis?
No, what happened here in Brazil probably a year ago was totally the opposite. Some guy got kidnapped because he had lots of points and he was bragging to all his friends and stuff like that. He had whatever virtual money they get on Second Life. So they kidnapped him and in order to return him, he had to give away whatever he had. That's awesome.
The thing about the Second Life money is it's freely exchangeable for actual money, so that's where the heavy issues are brought into play.
They physically kidnapped him for his virtual assets.
Yeah, it was a real kidnapping. Real kidnapping for virtual information.
That's brilliant.
I was wondering.
I don't think I can make the argument anymore how insane it is.
Wait a minute, though. But as soon as the guy is not kidnapped anymore, can't he just call the content provider and say, they stole my virtual assets? I don't understand. And they just shut it off? It doesn't make any sense. Anyway.
I was wondering if the case we were discussing last week where there was virtual adultery going on, whether they'll end up having a virtual divorce and whether he'll have to pay her virtual alimony.
Wait. I think this has gone on long enough.
Luis tells me, by the way, that he didn't choose to pursue reversing it out of fear, the real life consequences.
Well, I guess that makes sense.
Do we have any more time, or are we out of
time? We're pretty much out of time. I don't think we have time for phone calls, if that's what you're asking.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
But next week we'll certainly take phone calls.
Yes.
Our email address, as always, is oth@2620.com. We love hearing from our listeners, whether it's criticism, critique, whatever, just let us know. I guess maybe we should close off with some bit of information. Bernie, you dug up the Secret Service code names for the Obama family?
Oh, I did.
You want me to read them? I have them here. Maybe it'd be more fun to read them across
the
national borders.
It's widely known that Renegade is Barack Obama's code name. And see if I can remember the other ones. There were. Does anyone else have them in front of them?
Yeah, they're right here. Michelle Obama is Renaissance. Malia, am I pronouncing that right? Malia is Radiance. And Sasha, anyone want to guess what Sasha Obama's code name is?
Ren and Stimpy.
No.
I'm
going to
guess it starts with an R.
It has to start with an R.
Starts with an R, and it's the key to a major film. No?
No.
The answer is Rosebud.
Huh. I thought you were going to say Red Rum.
No, that would be a good one, though, wouldn't it?
It's interesting. The Secret Service
that information comes to you across international borders from Brazil, and hopefully didn't flag too many.
All right. Well, I think that's it for us then tonight, and we'll be back again next week, same time, same place. So,
good night from Brazil.
Good night.
Hello.
Hello, Chloe.
Hello, baby. Why did you wait so long to call? Hello, baby. Why did you wait so long to call? Well, I've been so sick and worried ever since you left last fall. Please, please tell me, why did you stay away so long? You know I've been so lonesome, staying here all alone. Well, I'm just so sick and worried. Baby, please come back
tomorrow. Bye.